Hello, everyone. Welcome to this podcast about ALS. We are delighted to have a clinical expert with us, Dr. Bedlack, who'll be talking to me about some interesting things about ALS and the look forward. Thank you for Dr. Bedlack for joining us. Welcome.
It's my pleasure to be here.
Okay, we're going to just jump right in and just kind of set the stage by having you tell us, what are the goals of therapy for ALS?
So, in my opinion, the goals of therapy should be tailored to each individual. And that's why in my ALS program, we start each visit by asking the patient to tell us what are they hopeful about. We ask them to list two or three things. Most patients do want to try and slow, stop, or reverse their ALS progression. And of course, most want to have the best quality of life for themselves and their families. But we do sometimes find people who simply want to optimize their comfort. And we even find some that have a very specific thing that they're hopeful about that we wouldn't have known about. Like some want to reach a specific milestone. They want to be able to attend the birth of a grandchild or go to a wedding or a graduation. And that allows us to really tailor that visit. I can remember some patients who wanted to reincorporate something that they loved and had lost. In particular, there's one patient that resonates with me. She loved fashion like I do. And because of her increasing disability due to ALS, she wasn't able to wear the types of clothing that she loved. And so that required a very personalized approach where we built a bridge to the NC State Fashion School. And now there's a class there every year where the students are trying to design clothing that's both stylish but also adaptive for people with disabilities. So I don't think there's a one size fits all. I think you kind of have to understand the goals of your patient and their family.
Perfect. Thank you so much. And with those goals in mind, I think that's an excellent response. We certainly do have some therapies we use. I know that there's symptomatic therapies, which we won't dive into too much on this interview. Let's go forward with the targeted therapy. So starting with riluzole, tell us a little bit about that agent and where it was in practice when it was first approved in 1995. And then let's move on to what your thoughts about the clinical efficacy, safety, and use of edaravone and tofersen.
Sure. Yeah. So I would say that riluzole is the most proven medication we have for trying to slow the progression of ALS. As you said, it was approved back in 1995 as an oral medication with multiple mechanisms of action. So it's a glutamate antagonist, but it also inhibits motor neuron hyperexcitability. And I don't think anyone doubts that it prolongs tracheostomy-free survival in ALS. Multiple large, long duration, randomized, double blind, placebo controlled trials have shown this, and so has almost every real world study that's ever been done. The downside is the effect size is not huge. It's probably somewhere between 2 and 19 months. But I do feel like for my new patients who have a goal of trying to live as long as they can with their ALS, I recommend that they try this. Now, in terms of the safety and the efficacy, I would say, safety-wise, most patients aren't going to experience problems. A very small percentage will have some nausea or some dizziness or some numbness in their mouth or a change in the way things taste. Very few patients will experience fatigue. A very small number, around 1 to 2%, will have significant elevations in their liver transaminases. And that's why, if you're going to start somebody on this, you have to check a baseline and you have to check those liver transaminases roughly every 3 months to make sure they're not getting worse as time goes on. And so I would say, overall, I do think it's the best drug we have for most people with ALS. But as far as limitations go, it isn't a wonder drug. It doesn't preserve function, it doesn't stop or reverse the progression of the disease, but it does prolong survival.
Awesome, great. That's perfect. And since that agent was has been used for a while, we've had some newer agents that target other mechanisms in the disease. So tell us about edaravone.
Yeah, so edaravone is an antioxidant. It was originally FDA approved in 2017 as an intravenous formulation, but now there's an oral formulation that was FDA approved in 2022. So the FDA approval is quite different for this drug compared to riluzole. Here, there was only one small, short duration, randomized, double-blind, placebo-controlled trial, and that really focused on highly selected patients. These were people with ALS from Japan. They were people who were in the first 2 years of their symptoms. They were people who had a lot of function, and they were people who were progressing at least an average to fast speed. So that's a small subset of patients. So another study that was presented to the FDA at that time that focused on a broader group of patients was not able to show an overall benefit. And the FDA approval was accomplished because in that one study, there was a small but statistically significant slowing in the rate of decline on a measure of disability called the ALS Functional Rating Score. So there was about a 28% slowing in the rate of decline on that compared to patients on placebo. That was statistically significant. There's some argument about whether it's clinically meaningful. I would say some people feel like any slowing is worth trying to go after, and other people feel like that degree of slowing is so small that it cannot be perceived by individual patients or clinicians. So after that approval, there have been some real-world studies. I would say the results of these have been mixed. Some suggest a benefit, some are not able to show a benefit. But I think one of the most important things that was done with this molecule is that another formulation, slightly different as far as the additives from the one that was FDA approved, was put into a traditional phase three trial, very large, very long phase three trial in Europe. And that showed absolutely no benefit, including in the subset of patients who were early with lots of function and progressing quickly. And so I think you'll find different opinions about the role of this drug. I certainly mention it to all my new patients, but I also advise them against taking it right now because I feel like the best study that's ever been done was unable to show any benefit. For those who do decide to pursue it, it does seem to be well tolerated. It does seem to be fairly safe. It is very expensive, much more expensive, about 10 times the cost of riluzole. I would say things to watch out for and people who are going to try it. About 10% of patients who try it will have contusions or gait disturbances or headaches. You do have to avoid using this in those rare patients who have a sulfite allergy because the product contains sulfite.
Okay, perfect. Great overview of that. I appreciate that. And then, even more recently, we've have another agent that again works on yet another mechanism within the disease called tofersen, approved, I believe, in 2023. Let me. What are your impressions about that agent and how it's fared in clinical use?
I would say tofersen is the first home run therapy that we've ever had in 150 years of studying ALS. So this is quite different from the other things we've talked about. It's not an oral agent. This is an antisense oligonucleotide that has to be injected intrathecally. So the first three doses are given every 14 days, and then after that, an intrathecal administration is given every month. And what this does is it targets the messenger RNA for a mutated gene that is a rare cause of ALS called superoxide dismutase 1, SOD1. So about 1 to 2% of everyone with ALS has it because of a mutation in this gene. And we've been modeling this gene for decades. We know exactly how mutations in this disease, in this gene, kill motor neurons. And therefore, it's not a surprise that we were able to develop a way to stop it. Now, the approval of this is even different from the last two approvals that we talked about. This is the first time in the history of ALS that something got an accelerated approval. What that means is that in the 6-month randomized double-blind placebo-controlled trial that was done, there wasn't an obvious clinical benefit in the people taking tofersen compared to the people taking placebo. There was a trend, but it did not reach statistical significance. What was seen is that this drug drastically reduced the concentration of mutant SOD1 protein in the spinal fluid, and it drastically reduced a biomarker called neurofilament light chain in the spinal fluid. So neurofilament light chain is released from any kind of neuron that is dying. And so it's not unique to ALS, but when we see it in this disease, we believe it's a measure of the burden of the disease. So people who are progressing more quickly have higher levels of neurofilament light chain. And so this was really the first trial where we saw a dramatic reduction, more than a 40% reduction in the amount of this biomarker. And there was such a strong belief at the FDA that this would predict a later clinical benefit that they gave it an accelerated approval. And what that was an approval where they said, we believe this is going to work. We're going to go ahead and get it in the hands of patients, but we want you to continue to give us more data. So that's where this is. And I will say now, if you look in the open label extension for that randomized double-blind placebo-controlled trial, it became quite clear over time that people who got tofersen early were doing much better from a standpoint of both function and survival compared to people who got placebo. And really, as we've followed individual patients in our practices, it's amazing what's happening. So I would say that most of us believe that our patients who are on this for more than a year are stabilizing. And some of us have even seen dramatic recovery of lost motor function, including people that were wheelchair bound that can now walk. We've never seen anything like this with any other therapy. So this is a home run. It's only for that one subset of patients, but we're very excited about what this might mean for other types of therapies. Now, we always have to talk about, potential problems with every therapy. So about 10% of people who get tofersen will have some side effects, pain, fatigue, increased spinal fluid white count. Very rarely, people can have more serious side effects that include papal edema, elevated intracranial pressure, myelitis, radiculitis, and aseptic meningitis. But even though these sound kind of scary, for most patients with this form of ALS, they feel like the potential benefits outweigh the potential risks. One thing that's limiting the more widespread use of this in patients with SOD1 is it's extremely difficult to give. Like we've already talked about the fact that this has to be given intrathecally. So, if you think about what that means, like when we're trying to give this to the three patients at our institution that have this form of ALS, we basically have to schedule a whole set of rooms, one room in the clinic for each patient. And that's in case we can get the medication in at the bedside, but also one room at interventional radiology, which is all the way across campus. In case we can't get the needle in at the bedside, we have to bring the patient all the way over there and get the needle in under X-ray guidance. The medication has to be purchased by the institution, so they have to buy and bill. So there's always a risk, a billing risk, but that also means we have to, as a provider, go and get the medicine from the pharmacy at our institution, which is on a whole other side of campus. Basically, what it means is we have to block off an entire half a day every month just to give this medication to these three patients. And so we do it because we believe this is a meaningful effect, but it's also quite challenging from a business standpoint for an institution to figure out how to break even on a medicine like this.
Wow, thank you so much. I really appreciate that you covered not only the efficacy, safety, mechanism of action, but just the practical point of practicing medicine and getting the medicine to the patient from every standpoint. So I appreciate that very much. And those medicines are kind of targeted therapies. I know that ALS has heterogeneity in how it manifests, and I know one of the manifestations or symptoms can be pseudobulbar effect. Tell me about dextromethorphan quinidine as an agent that is useful in this patient population.
Yeah, so this combination of dextromethorphan and quinidine was FDA approved in 2010 for this symptom complex, which is called pseudobulbar affect. So this is a situation where people lose control of their laughing and crying. And by itself, it can be devastating. So I remember a couple of stories. I remember one patient who had to give the eulogy from one of his best friends, and we had talked about it, and he was practicing. He wasn't, adept at public speaking, and he came back, and I asked how it went, and he was devastated because he couldn't stop laughing all throughout the eulogy due to his pseudobulbar affect. And I remember a grandmother who's, one of the things she enjoyed the most was spending time with her grandkids. And she went to see a new cartoon with them in the movies, and she couldn't stop crying throughout the whole cartoon. And so that made the grandkids kind of not want to be there with her. So this by itself can be devastating. And it's great that we have this medicine. It dramatically reduces both the frequency and severity of these attacks of unwanted laughing and crying. I would say it may do much more than that. So since its FDA approval, there now are two published randomized double-blind placebo-controlled trials suggesting that this can also improve bulbar function. So it can improve the clarity of speech. It can improve swallowing. It can improve a patient's ability to handle excessive oral secretions. Now, it does not have FDA approval for the treatment of bulbar function, so it's a little tricky. Right now, we can only prescribe it for folks who report pseudobulbar affect, but we can tell people that we're also hoping it will improve some of these other things too. As far as downsides, it is also expensive. Most people do tolerate it well, but we do sometimes hear about cases of diarrhea or dizziness or cough or peripheral edema. Because it has a tiny little bit of quinidine in it, quinidine is an antiarrhythmic, we do have to watch out for something called QT prolongation. And so I ask my patients who I'm thinking about prescribing this, do you know if you have this? Is there any question of it? Are you on any medications that might do this? Like some of the antidepressants can prolong the QT. And if there's any question, we do a baseline EKG. We look at the QT interval. We make sure it's not prolonged. We give a test dose of dextromethorphan quinidine in clinic. And 3 hours later, we repeat the EKG to make sure the QT hasn't prolonged. And if that test goes okay, then we go ahead and give the medicine. Not everyone needs that, of course, just people where you're worried that there could be a problem with the QT.
All right, perfect. Thank you. Moving on to the group, the team approach to managing patients. Lots of different symptom manifestations, a pretty complex set of symptoms they may have. So I understand that in this disorder, there is a important need for multidisciplinary care and collaboration among different specialists. Tell us about how. Give us some pearls about how that works best for an ALS patient, and particularly how it works at your institution.
Yeah, well, this disease can affect so many parts of a person so quickly that it's virtually impossible for one clinician to keep up. And so a multidisciplinary team will usually have a provider, which is typically a neurologist, as well as a whole team of therapists. So at my institution, we're lucky to have two neurologists and a PA as the providers, but we also have multiple respiratory therapists, multiple speech therapists, multiple physical therapists, multiple occupational therapists. We have a dietitian, we have a social worker, and we have a whole variety of nurses that are focused on different aspects of the disease. And we're constantly learning about things that we need to ask about, things that we need to measure. And we figure out who's the best person to address that particular aspect. But I'll give you an example. I mean, our team had been together for about 10 years and we'd seen several hundred patients already. And one day we learned that one of our patients who had no arm function at all was still driving. It was something that we didn't incorporate. Like, no one's responsibility was to ask, are you still driving? We just kind of figured there would come a time when people would realize it was time to stop driving. And we learned that that's not always obvious to folks. This particular person was driving from another state, using their knee on the steering wheel and their other leg to control the pedals. And so, we were shocked into saying, okay, occupational therapy, you need to ask every single person if they're driving. And if they are, we need to incorporate a driving screen into our assessment. And if we have any question, we need to make some recommendations about maybe going and doing an on-the-road driving test. But it's just one of many examples of things that over the years we've learned we need to be asking about, we need to be measuring. Just to help all of us understand the impact of the disease and to be able to offer options to give people the best and safest quality of life. I will say these clinics are powerful. I mean, there's no question that people who attend these types of clinics have more preserved quality of life. We also know that their survival is more than a year longer for people who attend these types of clinics compared to people who don't. But they're also incredibly challenging. They're challenging from a resource standpoint. Like they lose money. I mean, we occupy 20 exam rooms for an entire day and we have a team of 20 clinicians. Like those numbers don't make sense for 20 to 25 patients. Like if this was a Botox clinic for headache, I mean, they might see 50 or 60 patients and, it'd be one provider administering all this Botox. So that clinic would clearly be profitable, whereas my clinic is a huge money loser. Like we've figured out that we lose $150,000 to $200,000 a year for our institution. Now, how are we still able to do this in this day and age? Because we have to fundraise. So we're lucky to have partners like a patient advocacy group called ALS United and another one called the ALS Association that believe in what we're doing and give us a grant to offset those losses. So we're revenue neutral, but it is challenging. Like it's one thing to recognize that this is the best way to do it. It's another way to figure out like how do you make it work? And that for almost everyone who's doing this requires some fundraising.
Well, pivoting now for our last question, just want to get your feelings about what the horizon looks like, what the road forward looks like. What are you excited about that's in development? What if you could have your wish list about what you want the next 20 years of ALS therapy and treatment to look like? It's kind of your way of kind of forward thinking about what your hopes of the future are.
So I'm excited about a lot of things. I mean, first of all, I'm excited by the amount of activity in this space. When I started 25 years ago, we might have had one product in development a year. Now there's over 100 products in development for ALS. Now, I've come to believe that ALS is not the same disease in everyone. I mean, we know there's two categories of causes, genetic and non-genetic, and even within genetic ALS, there's 40 subtypes that we know about. And so, I mean, within the non-genetic ALS, there could be hundreds of subtypes. And what I mean by that is things, diseases that look very similar, but are caused by different combinations of genes and environment. And I think what tofersen has taught us is if we understand why someone has their disease, we can hit a home run. We can stop and in some cases reverse the disease, but we have a ways to go to understand a lot of these subtypes. And so I'm excited that there's so many natural history studies underway to help us understand these subtypes. I'm excited about the fact that there are people who've identified subtypes and there's therapies in development now for some of the other genetic subtypes like FUS and TDP43 and C9orf72. There's a group that believes that a non-genetic subtype of ALS might be caused by a retrovirus called human endogenous retrovirus K. And there's trials underway to try to target that retrovirus. I'm personally excited because I'm starting to understand outliers. Like I've always believed that there's something to be learned by people who are doing extraordinarily well with ALS. I've got people who are 10 years in who can still do marathons. I found a group of people who have ALS who recovered from it. Like there's something different about these people. And if we could understand what it was, we might be able to make outcomes like that happen more often. And my team has found some differences in the composition of the gut microbiome between slow and fast progressing patients. And we can take stool from those patients and put it into the mouse model of ALS and change progression. So we believe those changes are not just associations, they're actually reasons for progression outliers. And we're putting that to work in clinical trials this year. We're doing really, I think, the first informed clinical trials to try to change the gut microbiome in people with ALS to affect progression. And I've even found a target in those ALS reversals, a genetic polymorphism that controls the levels of a protein called IGF-BP7. This protein's never before been identified as potentially being important in ALS, but we now have multiple lines of evidence that it is. We see that it might be important in other neurodegenerative diseases. And we're going after this protein with a clinical trial at Duke later this year. So it's an incredibly exciting time. It's a hopeful time. And I myself am hopeful, and I've been really trying hard to be the best hope booster for my patients because I believe that hope is more than just an emotion or a coping strategy. I think hope itself is a treatment.